Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is my good friend, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
Hello.
And he is the co-host. I am also a co-host. My name is Mark Bigney. We are here to talk about board games today in a radical, radical departure. We always strive to uphold the same principles with which we founded this podcast, and that is to be the best Kingston-based hobbyist board game Gibbon-owned podcast that you are listening to at this moment.
Nailed it.
Thank you. And year on year, we aspire to that brass ring. Eventually, we'll get there. But it's just like what the Ontario Board of Education always says. It's important to have principles. So we're going to talk about board games this week. First, we're going to talk about the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus. We're then going to talk about the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And then our feature topic. Our feature topic is a publisher spotlight, Mind Clash Games. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
So 1 year ago, we reviewed Agricola. It is one of the essential first, you know, very tight worker placement games that where you had to feed your workers. So the more workers you got, the more penalties you had to take. And so the first feeling you would get would be, why would I get more workers when it essentially only feels like I'm taking actions to feed those extra workers until, you know, the combos start racking in and it actually starts to pay itself off. And then near the end of the game, it does have that sort of mathematical, do I need that one extra worker for the last turn, or am I going to be better off, you know, just using the ones that I have?
Well, in terms of workers, sadly, this is my chief criticism of Agricola, is that you always want the more workers because they're three extra points at the end of the game. The part where it gets brutally calculational is, well, I've got seven sheep. Do I get an extra point for getting an eighth, or do I want a marginal boar, or which one gives me the extra point? But look, we've played Agricola several times since we reviewed it. It is absolutely part of our regular rotation, especially since Walker came to appreciate it as much as Caverna. Previously, Walker was bigger on Caverna than Agricola. I was bigger on Agricola than Caverna, again, because it's tighter. But now I think it's safe to say that Agricola is equally appreciated by both of us. It is in the swag canon. And it's difficult to look back and remember the hobbyist landscape before Agricola because it set the standard for so many things. It introduced a decade-long period of relentless worker placement games. We still get lots of them, but I think that the tempo has kind of slackened. It introduced an era of Euros where you had to feed your workers, where there were serious resource constraints on you. And it basically revolutionized Euro components with Animeeples. Like, before that, seriously, like
it was cubes, yeah.
Yeah, it was cubes for everything. And Agricola just basically, like, from Agricola to Meeple Source, that's, you know, straight line, no confusion about it. And it deserves absolutely all its accolades. You can take any edition. The revised edition is fine. The original edition is fine.
The fact that it came out with a 15-year anniversary edition,
which had its own production problems, which we don't necessarily fully endorse.
No, but still popular in the groups.
We love other Uwe Rosenberg worker placement games, especially A Feast for Odin and Hallertau, I think, in terms of more recent output. But it is hard to deny the importance of Agricola, as well as just how fun it is still to this day. So that is what we reviewed a year ago today. Agricola by Uwe Rosenberg, published by Lookout Games, originally in 2007, but more latterly in its revised edition in 2016.
With a billion expansions.
Yes, any number of expansions, a whole bunch of add-on modules and decks. And do you want minis in your Agricola? You can have minis in your Agricola. You want other boards? You can have other boards. They're just cosmetic, but you can have them. So, Walker, now on to the games we played last week. What'd you play last week?
Speaking of worker placement, Mark, I played a game called Ceres a couple of times, designed by Josef Sundström and published by Artipia Games. And I believe the hook in this one, which I found interesting, is that there's sort of two types of workers. You have your leaders, which are your own. You have five of them, and they go out onto the board and populate workspaces. And even in a two-player game, those workspaces were tight. The second kind of worker are astronauts, and they're in a common pool. And they're going to be activating your buildings, which are color-coded, and the astronauts are color-coded. You must pick the right color of astronaut, and you have to look over at your opponents and see what buildings they have left or how many of a certain building they have, because you want to make sure you're going to be able to activate your buildings. The other interesting part about that is that these dropships are coming in every turn, and they're populated with more astronauts, so they're going to be entering the system, and so you can sort of steer your building purchases based on what, you know, what the mix of astronauts going to be. It's like, oh, we're going to get a lot of gray this game. Well, I'll get more gray buildings that will increase the chance of me being able to activate these buildings.
I am ready to be a complete and total hypocrite, or at least say something that makes me sound like a complete and total hypocrite. I wanted Ceres to lean more into the tableau building aspect of the game because you're right. You're buying these buildings. The color matters. You get to upgrade the buildings and you get to kind of build your own economy. And it's that part is grafted onto a relatively pedestrian worker placement aspect. I didn't find the worker placement part of the game very interesting. I found the part of building your own tableau and activating it with the common workers vastly more interesting. And so I wanted it to be half the game. And it's not that it was overlong or bloated or anything. It's reasonably straightforward as far as things go, with one salient exception. And that is I found, and again, this was more prevalent in the worker placement aspect, but it's still prevalent in the engine building aspect. There was a weird circularity with respect to a lot of the iconography. It's like, okay, I'm taking an action represented by the crane. Well, what does the crane let me do? Well, the crane lets me do this kind of conversion or activate the sort of shuttle action. Well, what's a shuttle action? Okay, well, this shuttle action means that... So for a relatively straightforward economy of relatively straightforward resource conversion, it took me longer than it should have to really understand what was going on. I'm not sure if this is a core problem with the design or merely a problem with the way information was presented, but it certainly didn't make me positively inclined towards Ceres at first blush, and it served to really kind of obfuscate how to get from point A to point B. You know, there's this aspect of, this is the thematic aspect. Sci-fi games should really be about mechs if they can be. I've got my prejudices. I'm just laying it out flat on the table. Mining is not interesting. I would venture to say that a lot of miners might even be inclined to agree. Anyway, send all your angry miner hate mail to support@aircanada.ca. And you send out mining robots to various asteroids in and around Ceres. And that part was okay. But again, it was done through a rocket action, which is not an action. It's an icon that shows up under other actions. And so it ended up making things feel more sort of attenuated, more distant, more convoluted than they actually were. And again, it distracted me from the part that I actually liked, getting new cards and activating
those
cards.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They had some very interesting ideas that never really got flushed out. Much like you said, like building your tableau, like this, you know, three-tier turning asteroid field that all you did was put out probes and it gave you income, right?
Yeah.
That's all it did.
Yeah.
If it was something a little bit more interesting with such crazy moving parts and and mechanisms to get out there, then it might have been something.
I mean, something. Like, for example, it wouldn't have even needed to change that much about the core aspect of the asteroids. Maybe there's something we can only get from the asteroids, right? That, I think, would have provided an excellent motivating feature. As it was, you know, it's a, as I say, a pretty standard Euro conversion resource game in Saris. You know, I need to get a couple ceramic. Okay, well, that asteroid could give me a couple ceramic. This building could give me a couple ceramic. This space could give me a couple ceramic. Okay, I'll just go. There wasn't anything really special going on, except, again, I felt a little bit of ownership over my cards. I get to customize them a tiny bit. I got to, again, as you said, try to accommodate the supply of astronauts coming in. I did a very poor job, and I felt the sting of that. And that part struck me as vastly more interesting. And so ultimately what you're left with in Saris is a very generic sort of middle-of-the-road experience without leaving much of an impression, sadly, which is a shame. I really like the publisher, Artipia Games, has done some really interesting stuff. I haven't played anything else by Gustav Sundström before, but it was largely forgettable.
Agreed. It does have a nice build-up. It only lasts 3 turns. Your first turn goes very quickly. And then there's, like I said, with the more workers that come into the system, the more buildings you get out, there's this huge build-up, and then it ends fairly quickly. So the timing and the tempo is nice, but ultimately there are better worker placement games than this.
That is Saris by Gustav Sundström, published by Artipia Games this year, pursuant to a successful crowdfunding. Walker has a little Velcro patch.
I do have, and on that note of components, it has this weird thing where it has a very nice sort of component track where you keep track of all your resources because it has one resource and you move it up this track. But then that has these other like credits and advanced iron. We're not going to use the track for that.
Yeah.
We're going to have tokens for that stuff. We don't want to use it. It's so weird.
It was a little bizarre. It's true. I played Daybreak again. This is an Insta-Urus. This is my cheeky term for an Instant-Urus. Playing a game very shortly after reviewing it for the first time, which is always a mark of quality. I don't think there's ever been an Insta-Urus where that wasn't a definite vote in favor of a given game. Daybreak being the cooperative game about climate change by Matt Leacock and Matteo Menapace. And this definitely emphasizes everything that I commented on last time. It presents a very interesting universe of a lot of different incommensurate but very, very important tools to decarbonize. And in a tableau building game in the vein of something like Terraforming Mars, it's good to have a nice variety of different effects and a nice variety of thematic explanations for those effects. And again, like every in-person playing of Daybreak, I was tempted to pull out my phone and scan one of the QR codes to find out what it had to say about a given technology that I didn't know anything about. So I got to learn something, which was wonderful. I maintain Daybreak is too easy. I'm not a huge fan of the way that it makes things harder. One of the key ways that it makes things harder is through these restriction cards that are either global or individual, and they basically just make you unable to pull some of the levers that exist in a game of Daybreak. That makes me feel like I'm playing less of a game, not that I'm playing more of a game. I have the same complaint for what it's worth in some of the higher difficulty levels in Spirit Island, for example. In some of the higher difficulty levels of Spirit Island, it's just you don't have more things to deal with. You just have fewer things you can do to deal with the things you need to do. Now, this is an exception rather than the rule, and there are other ways to make Daybreak harder. You can pick different factions to make things harder. You can start with fewer trees or less water. But suffice to say that all told, I think it suffers in comparison to Pandemic in terms of its difficulty modification. I'm actually going to be recording an episode of Bloat this week with another comparison between Daybreak and Pandemic. Not that they're all that similar games, but just in terms of how your comment about Daybreak was very good. You said that one of the things you didn't like about Daybreak was you felt it was rather random in terms of its distribution of cards and in terms of the environmental effects that you might suffer. And that is, I think, entirely legitimate. And what I think it serves to highlight some of the differences between Daybreak and Pandemic. I think Pandemic is a superior design, but again, for me, as someone who adores Pandemic, I think Pandemic is, again, one of those epic-making hobby designs. Being second fiddle to Pandemic is no problem at all. So, thoroughly enjoyed my game of Daybreak, even though I confess it is probably too easy for my taste, all told. But I stand by everything we said last week.
I, too, have been playing Daybreak on Board Game Arena, which it's giving me this odd feeling because I'm playing another video game called Backpack Hero. And the similarities between these are just sort of weird.
Really?
Yeah, just because in Backpack Hero, you're trying different combos. It's like this time I'm going to try.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying the cleaver combo, or I'm trying
the cleaver combo, you said.
Or the brass knuckle combo, or all sorts of different ways you can make these weapons and items interact with each other. But you're under the scrutiny of after you kill a wave of monsters, you're going to get a random assortment of goodies.
Oh, I see.
Much like Daybreak, you just say, okay, what cards am I going to get this turn? And
sure.
How am I going to incorporate this into this combination I'm trying to do? Or am I going to, much like you do in Backpack Hero, trash everything and use these new cards to go forward, you know, from then
right.
on? Yeah, it's just this, because you're playing them both at the same time, sort of in the background, it's like, this is very similar.
Interesting parallel. I like it. That is Daybreak by CMYK Games.
We got to play and stream a game called Raising Robots. This is designed by Brett Sobel and Seth Van Orden. I've talked about it before. This is published by Nuvo Games. And this time it was placed with Warm Boy and Sidewinder, who are both big Wingspan fans. And by the end, Warm Boy, who owns Wingspan, said that he would rather play this.
If
given the opportunity. Sidewinder was the opposite. She still said, you know, Wingspan was the game.
Mm-hmm.
I do also enjoy this much more than I do Wingspan. There's definitely a comparison there, but it is different in many ways. What you're doing is you have this line, because it's simultaneous play, because you can get through a game so much faster than you can of Wingspan, because everyone is doing their turn on their own thing. You can see in the stream, you know, you sort of walk everyone through the first turn, and then from then on, all you're doing is everyone establishes the energy for the turn, and then you run through your own sort of systems. You're building these columns of robots that you can run as long as you've rolled for the galaxy style, picked that action, or someone has put energy into that action. And so you're hoping that there's energy there, or you bump it up with battery, and you're running these lines of robots and getting resources and improving your tableau. I'm very much looking forward to showing it to you.
Yeah, Louis was speaking very, very highly about Raising Robots. I guess it's all the rage. It's all anyone's talking about, Walker.
The artwork is exquisite. There is this giant deck of robots, and every single one is different. You have like your breakfast-making robot, or your foot massage robot, or sports robot, or camera robot, and the artwork.
I have seen the cards. They are aggressively charming. It's very, very well done.
So looking forward to playing more Raising Robots. Great little game.
On the topic of Little Walker, I got to return to Demon Ship. This is the 15mm copy made for me by the Hanwerker. This is a solo miniatures game designed by Maliv and Blacksite Studios. And it is available in a printed version, but it's also available in a 3D printable version, and that is indeed the fodder for which the Hanwerker made me my own little twee copy. Normally it's 28 mil scale, but at half size, you can put it into a tiny little tin. And additionally, the Hanwerker, because he stumbled across them, has now made super deformed Doom miniatures. So imagine, if you will, a 15 millimeter super deformed demon or Doombringer from Doom. They are so cute. It is marvelous. So I had to go back to Maliv's creation. And true to his word, after I played the first time and I commented that, like many independent miniatures games, it absolutely needed a good player aid, because there are spawning rules, AI rules, action rules, reaction rules, and of course, being an indie miniatures game, they're scattered across four different chapters. And so the last time I played without a player aid, I actually played right in front of a super wide monitor, and I had four browser windows open with all the relevant places. So I was either going to come up with my own player aid, but the designer said he was going to make his own. Sure enough, it is now available, and it is excellent. It has exactly the information I want, and thus it is the only thing that I need. Of course, now my printer doesn't work, but alas, this time I had to play it in front of my computer, but I only needed one window open, so progress. And there's a lot of dice rolling in Demonship, but it's the kind of dice rolling that I like. What it determines is the parameters of what's going to happen during the round, not whether or not a thing happens over the course of the round. So yeah, you throw a bunch of dice to determine how a room is set up. Sure, fine. But that just lays the stage for what's going to happen. And then you roll a whole bunch of dice to determine what the enemies are going to do. But all the actions of the enemies, all the reactions of the enemies, and all of your actions are deterministic in terms of their execution. And that is exactly how I prefer my buckets of dice to, well, speaking loosely, of course, buckets of dice is sometimes deployed as a technical term in the consim hobby field for conflict resolution mechanism. But the kinds of decisions you're faced with in Demonship, not the deepest thing in the world, but certainly very satisfying. I can do action A, and then a monster will engage in reaction X. Can I do action A in such a way that I'll be reasonably safe from reaction X? Or I can do action B and suffer reaction Y. And again, since the consequences of these actions are deterministic, you end up with some interesting trade-offs. And so there's a little bit of a sense of scope. It's just the right length. It's super, super short, which for solo games, especially when the decision-making is satisfying but not especially deep, that is exactly what you want. So you get to play with your little toy. The rules are straightforward. Decision-making is interesting. I really like Demonship. It's really well done. And I highly recommend that anybody in a position to give it a shot from the, if you've got a 3D printer, if you have things that you can kitbash or just use generic minis for and just print up the terrain or even mock up the terrain, anybody who's done indie miniatures gaming before knows the tools and techniques that are required to deal with these kinds of products. I highly recommend it. It's really quite interesting. Apparently, Maliv is going to be doing a follow-up that's kind of sort of inspired by Demonship, that's going to be about gladiatorial combat. It's going to be coming soon-ish, they say, on Blacksite Studios. I'm very interested to see how that shakes out. Anyway, I'm a big fan of Demonship, especially when it is incredibly adorable. So thanks again to the Handwerker, whose generosity is as capacious as his skills. And thanks also to the designer for finally making an excellent player reference available. It definitely facilitated my playings of Demonship, designed by Maliv de Shinobi, published by Blacksite Studios.
So when the OGs get together, Mark, it is five of us. And five-player games we enjoy. One is Hyperborea. This is designed by Andrea
Caravesio and Perluca Zizzi.
Thank you.
No problem.
Put out by Asmodee here in North America. And it is a great troops on the map type game where you get to hire these menagerie cards that will improve your action selection. It's a bag builder. You're putting all these different colored cubes into the bag. You're going up tracks to get more cubes. You're fighting enemies to build up either ghosts or different colors of all the different enemies. You're triggering terrain effects. It's all there, and in a short time and smooth play and very high tension, because it's one of these, this particular type of bag building is you keep drawing until you empty the bag, and you're drawing three cubes every time. So when it gets to near the bottom, if you only have one cube left, then guess what, you get one cube for that turn. And so you're trying to time it just right. You're trying to add cubes desperately to your bag. And then you have three and you're great. And you know your next turn is going to be great. And then someone plays an ability and says, I'll give you this really cool extra cube. Isn't that nice of me? And now you're back to having one cube in your bag. And you resist the urge to strangle them. And sometimes you can't.
Walker, what I think you're referring to an effect that Dewey triggered a number of times, whereby he would get to draw three extra cubes from his bag and gift his neighbors with one cube draw. What I don't think you understand is it is, in terms of tempo, roughly equal if you get a four-cube turn followed by a two-cube turn or a three-cube turn followed by a three-cube turn. It may be less satisfying to reach into that bag and only have two cubes waiting for that turn. Anyway, Hyperborea is my favorite bag builder. It uses bag building the best. And what was particularly revealing about this play, because we played it a whole bunch of times, it's in the canon, it's one of our go-tos, everyone in the OG group, as you refer to it, very much enjoys it. It's not at its best with five, but it plays really well with five. And I'd rather play it with three or four. I think it's better at those counts. But as you say, with five, it moves along at a pretty decent clip most of the time. And what I really like about the bag building is that, and this was very much manifested in this most recent play, it allows you to make mistakes. It gives you just enough rope to play suboptimally. Not so that you're going to be paralyzed and be unable to get anything done, but enough so that you can look through the mid-game and realize, oh, I need to correct. And then, of course, if you're like me, fail to do so. In fact, we both did that.
Yes.
We were both, it was fascinating. I'm sure a psychologist would make hay out of this. We would say things like, I really need to stop adding blue cubes to my bag. And then literally during the same turn, okay, I add two blue cubes to my bag. And then everyone else at the table was like, what? I'm taking my turn. Leave me alone.
Yeah, or I need this extra action that uses up these awful gray cubes that I don't need anymore and these blue cubes that I shouldn't have gotten in the first place. Instead, I'll get this one that uses red cubes.
Yeah. Yeah. We were, and as a consequence, we had, and this sometimes happens, but not often, we had too many cubes and not enough things to do with them. Frequently, the opposite problem is true. This was partially a function of our own stupidity, and this is also partially a function of the variable map setup, because on the board, you mentioned that you get to trigger a map effect. It's one of the great things about Hyperborea. It's one of the ways you do combos.
Great timing aspect to that.
Absolutely. There was a central hex that almost everyone occupied at one point or another. It was a charnel house that generated a lot of cube generation. And we would all go in and out. It was a huge revolving door of corpses. That's basically what was happening at the hex in the center. And as a consequence, we all had a lot of cubes. Some of us made better decisions than others about how to make those cubes.
Agreed.
And again, I think this is the sign of good decision making. We had to make some strategic choices on top of our tactical maneuvering about how best to balance our economy. I balanced my economy really, really badly. And I paid for it. Was I locked out of the game? Was I unable to do things? No, but I definitely felt the consequence of my bad decisions. That balancing act is one of the things that I look for in a good hobby game, one of those perennials that you pull out year after year. Hyperborea, for me, absolutely qualifies. And that is how I like bag building to be done. So, still a huge, huge fans of Hyperborea, and it's one of the reasons why I keep putting it in the bag month after month after month.
And the expansion is fantastic as well. It introduces these black and white cubes, which very much increases the puzzle element of the game and how to manipulate getting more cubes out of the bag and what is in your bag.
And a whole bunch of stuff that is not as good. In point of fact, as we were tearing down the game, a number of people started pointing to various components that I never include in the game. Well, what's that? What's that? Oh, well, that's relics. They're not very good. Oh, those are leaders. I think we're going to have to show them. I don't know that you've ever tried them.
We did.
I think next time we play Hyperborea, we're going to have to show them those components so they never ask again.
It's true.
It's not that they're that bad. It's just that Hyperborea is a wonderful game, and the black and white cubes are a brilliant addition to the game, and the other aspects aren't as good. Because even in the core game, before you even add the expansion, one chief difficulty with Hyperborea that's been observed by a lot of the fans is it's the Terra Mystica problem. The factions don't seem very well balanced. It is what it is. And I'm willing to deal with it. I'm willing to live with that. I like the game enough. But I think that once you start adding in yet more of the unbalanced toys, unlike my comments about the Revive expansion, which seemed to balance some of the minor imbalances in the economy, my perception is that some of the other stuff in the Hyperborea expansion, Light and Shadow, that we do not use, just make the problem worse.
Exacerbates the problem.
So that's Hyperborea, Andrea Chiaravasio, and Perla Kadzitsi, originally published by Asterion, back before Asmodee swallowed everyone in 2014.
Lastly for me, there's just a few games I'll just mention quickly. Playing lots of games on Board Game Arena, Martian Dice, Gnar. Gnar is so great on Board Game Arena.
Mm.
It was a week of just playing games over, and that's something I don't normally do, playing games twice in a week.
Well, one game we played together on Board Game Arena was Valbara. Valbara was designed by Olivier Sipierre, published by, well, it says Studio H here, but I think it's Studio H. Teach the controversy. So Valbara was recommended to us by a listener who put it under the sort of broad category of action selection drafting, kind of in the mold of Citadels. I'm not sure that's the most accurate way to put it. It feels very much to me like a blind bidding game. Effectively, everyone's got the same deck of cards. You've got a hand of a subset of those. Everyone plays one simultaneously. They're revealed. And then what you do is, in order from lowest number to high number, again, a great controversy, is a low number better for initiative or a high number better for initiative? People have strong opinions. You then take a land card, and the land cards are what give you points. And there are special abilities associated with the various leaders, but never in such a way that I was seriously concerned with what other people were going to play, and never really in such a way that my primary focus was on the toys of the leaders. It was pretty much a case of, I look at the lands that are available. Do I care a great deal about which one I get? I do. I play my lowest card. Do I not care at all about the land that I get? Okay, I'll play the leader that gives me the most points.
Yeah, but I think maybe what they're trying to allude to is if you start card counting and remembering all of the leaders that the other players have played, maybe. And then therefore you can justify, yeah, I am not that type of player, nor do I ever want to be, but all the power to them. I enjoyed it for what it was. It was a quick little card game. You are trying to pair up the leader special abilities with the different types of lands that you're collecting. They let you do all sorts of different things. Some of them trigger off the lands, some of them do their own thing.
It was okay. Yeah. I definitely have a better sense of it playing in person, because I think that Valbara would, my estimation of how good Valbara is and how much I'd be likely to play would matter a lot based on how much time it takes in real life, right? So Gnar is super quick and breezy in both real life and in Board Game Arena, and it absolutely is worth its, I don't know, 25 to 30 minutes when playing in real life. Gnar at 45 to 60 minutes would be considerably less appealing. Similarly with Valbara, I need to get a feel for it. I'm not really good at translating Board Game Arena into real life durations, but I wasn't particularly grabbed by playing online. But if it's only about 20, 25 minutes in real life, I'd be willing to play it. But it wasn't, it didn't strike me immediately as one of the top tier fillers released in the past few years. And that is Valbara by Olivier Sipierre. Available on Board Game Arena, if you're so inclined. Lastly, we went back to Septima. Specifically, this time we were playing Septima with Shapeshifting and Omens, the pack-in expansion from the crowdfunding fulfillment, and that is packed in with the deluxe edition, which is what we have. And this time we were also playing the full game. Now, one of the things is, and we'll be talking more about this later on in the topic, I was fooled, I was deceived, Walker. Any other publisher, pretty much any other publisher, who tells me in the rulebook, it's like, don't play the full game your first game. Play the basic game a couple times until you're ready. You're not ready yet.
You take baby steps.
Yeah.
Your little baby, stay in baby land.
Yeah. I look at that and I ignore it, and I decide, based on the rules of the full game, whether that's the game I want to play, and, you know, 9 times out of 10, the answer is yes. When Mind Clash tells me that, I was willing to take them at their word. Then I ended up feeling fooled, because the base game, it feels like a neutered experience. The full game feels better. There's more going on. There's more trade-offs. There's more reason to go and do things. There's toys that get introduced in the form of spells. And the expansion in terms of shape-shifting was, you know, certainly manageable in terms of complexity. We're not talking about huge leaps in terms of complexity, but we are talking about specifically in terms of the full game experience, not strictly speaking the shape-shifting. We are talking about a significant opening up of the decision space. And so I would recommend anyone who's going to go play Septima, who is experienced with, you know, medium-heavy Euros, to ignore their advice and go straight to the full game. I know there are so many people thinking, of course, Mark, that's what we did. We're not silly. It's like, I'm sorry.
We're not babies.
We're not. Well, Walker, we don't want to insult people who prefer the base game. That's perfectly reasonable. People could like whatever they like.
It's true.
But preferring the base game doesn't make you a baby, but by the same token, the rulebook's claim of, oh, nobody's ready for the full game straight out the gate, that's not true. All of that having been said, I still don't feel particularly good about Septima. I still felt like the ratio of time that that players were doing things versus just managing a whole bunch of other steps, and it was way too low. And what I was doing didn't seem like it was manifesting on the awesome theme or particularly interesting in its own right.
Yes. By the end of it, you're playing all these cards. You're just, you know, taking your free move and moving around this map that really didn't mean anything. You're just trying to stay near the middle so you wouldn't get hunted.
Yep.
Doing minimal actions. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
Yeah, it was like, honestly, it felt a tiny little bit, this is a forced analogy, but just in terms of reference, I had the same vague sense of dissatisfaction with what I was doing in Septima that I did in Ceres. But Ceres, by contrast, is much quicker and cleaner, and with much less upkeep every round. Whereas in Septima, I think, makes a cardinal sin in terms of round structure of Euros specifically, but games in general. If you're going to have everyone do, say, 4 or 5 things over the course of a given turn, there's a world of difference between me saying, it's my turn, I do my things 1 through 5, my turn is done, versus, okay, everyone do 1, okay, everyone do 2, everyone do 3, especially when elements 1, 2, 4, and 5 aren't really actions. They're just things that the game is taking care of, right? I understand why Septima structured the way that it did. You would have to redesign the game to make it work the way I wanted to. But the problem is that makes it feel so tedious and much longer than it would otherwise. So it's just you're constantly losing focus with what you're actually doing. You end up feeling like you have less agency, even though you're accomplishing the same amount of stuff. And again, the theme is wonderful. The theme is, as Septima, that you're running a coven of witches. You've got to go heal the townsfolk, but by the same token, they're distrustful of you. And you have to manage their distrust of you. And at the same time, you want to try to make sure that the witches who do get captured, either from the system itself or from the actual players, that you manipulate the trials so that they get acquitted and then they come join your coven. That's great. The idea of helping the people who hate you and try to do it in a sort of low-key way with elements of politics, a lot of promise that I did not feel realized.
No, and it has this interesting sort of hook where if players play the same card, you get a benefit, like from the bottom of the card, but then you get more suspicion thrown on you, and then there's sort of a dummy player that you have to cycle every turn, and if you match them, you also get suspicion. It was weird.
Yeah, honestly, there are two things that I think it's a bit frustrating because Septima has a lot of promise. There are elements that I like that are just kind of drowned out by a failure to realize the theme and a structure that I think doesn't lend to its strengths. I would suggest two changes in terms of a redevelopment of Septima, not that this is ever going to happen. Number one is, as I said, the round structure needs to change so that I do 1 through 5, not that we waste our time resetting every time. And the other is, I think it should be a negotiation game. There are situations where Septima is built around collusion, but I don't have anything to offer anyone and they don't have anything to offer me. It's like, okay, I'm going to shapeshift this turn. Anyone else want to shapeshift with me? It's like, I was planning on doing it next turn and I don't need the sharing bonus. Leave me alone. Like, it's like, okay. There's no, if there were opportunity for weird betrayal, like, oh, I thought you were going to collude with me, but you're not.
There was a few times that could have happened. Like, remember, there's a lot of turns where I was in trouble, where I would have been hunted had I played the same card as someone else.
Right, but in those contexts, we had no interest. You had no interest in broadcasting what you were doing, and so I had no way to know what you were doing to try to harass you if I were so inclined.
Maybe, but a few of the times I said what I was going to do.
Why? I'm sincerely curious. This isn't me being
like,
a
why
joke.
Did I say I'm not sure at the time.
Okay.
I'm just saying that if someone had played the same card I did, then I would have been caught and I would have lost one of my wins.
Sure.
Yes.
And had it been a negotiation game, you could have been in a position to bribe them so as not to do that.
Yeah.
There could have been some dynamic about this collusion rather than, again, the prospect of collusion and failing to collude and incentives to collude is one of those elements of the theme that I was really looking forward to in Septima, and I didn't feel it was manifest.
I think what I gave up my action was only because I had said, maybe someone had asked, you know, well, why don't we do this turn? It's like, well, no, I need to do this turn. Or I can't do that because I'll get caught. I'm going to do this instead.
Sure.
Why don't we do this next turn type thing.
Yeah, if Septima had been structured around circumstances into which it would have been in our interest to predate on you in that way, and or you could have been in a position to offer something so as to force us to cooperate with you, that I think would have been a more interesting player-led dynamic.
Agreed. Instead, it was just very mechanical.
Very procedural. You just spend a lot of time doing upkeep and maintenance, and part of it is just a quirk of the structure, I maintain, but alas. That is Septima, specifically with the Shapeshifting and Omens expansion, designed by Robin Hegedus, published by Mindclash Games this year pursuant to successful crowdfunding, and then we will never talk about Mindclash again. Those are the games we played last week. Now we take a quick break to pay some bills.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
And now, back to the show and some news that does not matter. Mark.
Walker.
Phantom Division is bringing up a new project on GameFound. I don't know, not sure how it's going to work out. This is Phantom Division RL. So I'm not sure if we sort of drive around discs and bang into each other, or have they developed spacecraft and we're going to go to other planets and get in firefights.
No, this is Phantom Division Real Life. This is the reality show version.
Oh, okay.
Where there's just cameras on 24/7 and you have these sci-fi operatives talking about how Linda didn't label her food properly in the fridge again.
Oh, Linda.
She does it all the time. No matter how many times you tell her, she's just not going to do it.
We've tried.
Yeah. So I look forward to another round of the discussion as to whether or not they're using AI art.
So yes, it is Phantom Division Reloaded, and it'll be back on GameFound. And maybe they'll come up with an explanation this time now with no AI art.
Who knows? Or at least they'll talk about it. Like, look,
yeah.
We are of the position that disclosure and transparency is very helpful for the hobby. I hope we've made that clear by modeling in terms of disclosure of review copies, disclosure of personal relationships with other designers and publishers where they show up. Disclosure is helpful. Disclosure is better than not, suffice to say. So all that is on GameFound right now is the preview page. Despite the lack of information at this stage, we're still very enthusiastic because of its relationship to SEAL Team Flicks, the only game that matters. So we're looking forward to more details to come in the fullness of time. Also on GameFound is a game called 1793 Patriots and Traitors. This is a multiplayer card-driven game about the French Revolution. And I love me games about the French Revolution. Those of you who've been listening to me for a while know that I'm a big, big fan of La Révolution Française, La Patrie en Danger, 1791-1795. And this is the name of the game, Walker. What do you want?
Yeah, okay.
I will not be subject to language shaming.
I said nothing.
The gall that you would have. Anyway, this appears to be a much simpler game than La Patrie en Danger, which is a 4 to 5 hour multiplayer experience. But I'm very enthusiastic about any kind of card-driven multiplayer game. That is very much my jam when it seeks to be redolent with historical details. And I'm very, very enthusiastic to see what comes out of it. So I backed that to 1793, Patriots and Traitors on GameFound. John Claudus of Small Box Games broke into public consciousness in a big way with one of his most successful releases over 10 years ago called Omen, A Reign of War. It's been published by a couple of different publishers over its lifespan. And John Claudus, with his company Small Box Games, has reacquired the rights and is going to be crowdfunding a series of standalone redeveloped versions of Omen next year. I'm very much looking forward to that. Omen is a fascinating design. John Claudus is a very, very interesting designer, and a lot of his card games, he does two-player card games. It's his thing. It's his shtick. It's his deal. And they tend to have very interesting multi-use functions of how to use the cards. I'm a fan of the North, I'm a fan of Omen, and I'm very, very curious to see what he does with Omen. That will be the next version of Omen. Look for it sometime next year. Certainly more details to follow. That is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now onto our topic, and that is Mind Clash games. Walker, what comes to mind for you when you think of Mind Clash games?
Intricate, puzzly, interesting, well-produced games.
That was perfect, Walker. There you go.
Put a stamp on it.
Yeah. Thank you all for joining us. Yes. So what was your first Mind Clash game that you tried?
I think it was Anachrony.
I think it was Anachrony for me, too.
And just the premise of Anachrony just made you want to play it. It was you're going to go back in time, and you're going to steal resources from the past. And you're going to...
No, no, it's the other way around. The past is going to steal resources from the future.
That's it. Anyway, there's time travel.
Yes.
And there's resource thievery.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't think about it too hard. The time paradox will drive you mad. Yeah.
And if you don't somehow, by the end of the game, replace that, there's going to be some sort of weird paradox stuff happening. And so you have to manipulate everything in a way that time doesn't get distorted.
Yeah, normally it's the case that when someone uses a whole bunch of words to cover up for what they want as a loan. I actually had this experience recently. Someone sent me like a page-long email explaining what was going to happen. And I'm like, that's a lot of words for interest-free loan. Crowdfunding is actually much the same way. It's like you get to be a participant in the interest-free loan. effectively, that's what Anachrony has you do to yourself. But normally I'm skeptical, but call it time travel and I'm there for it. Yeah, Anachrony was the first Mind Clash game that I'd ever played. And I got it in trade, as I recall. And mostly I'm a sucker for giant stompy mechs. And layer onto that, solid worker placement. And I was completely sold. It's a hard genre. It's a hard, like, niche that Mind Clash has more or less set itself up for. And that niche is mostly, like, 2.5 hour long Euros, right? It's hard to do that well. Certainly for my tastes. Because very often I'm like, make it shorter. Make it shorter. That's a common I have for most things. And yet the fact that they've been so consistently successful in terms of a lot of their designs has been very, very impressive.
So their first two games were Anachrony and Trukerion. And they both sort of had the same sort of concept. They were worker placement games where not only did you go to a place that had an action, they were sort of ranked as opposed to what order in which players got there.
Right.
Right. So the first person in usually got a better action, and then they just sort of went downhill from there. And some were, you know, arguably better than others, and some of them were like sort of time dependent. It's like, well, normally this would be good in the first turn, but I'm going to go to this lesser spot because this particular turn I need this one thing.
Another aspect of... There are two more aspects of commonality between Trukerion and Anachrony. I like Trukerion just fine. I vastly prefer Anachrony. Trukerion was, I think, my least favorite Mind Clash design before we played Perseverance. More on that later. They have different kinds of workers. By and large, I really like worker placement games where you have different kinds of workers if you can do it well. Sometimes it just gets too restrictive and too convoluted, but I think both Trukerion and Anachrony do it very, very well in terms of having specialized workers. And as well, again, more so than other kinds of Euros, not to a great extent, but they tended to be very, very successful at bringing together a couple of mechanical elements, but a lot also with the graphic design to sell a really good theme. And I very much appreciated the setting in Trukerion. They carried it through very well, sort of pseudo-Victorian, not really, stage magicians. And Anachrony, of course, with its... like, they go so far in Anachrony, you know, every faction has its own, like, political ideology about how to run the post-apocalypse. And I admire that kind of flights of fancy, really, because you don't have to go into that level of detail. You just be like, well, we're the green faction. We want the future to be green. Instead, we have these, like, well, we've designed these mechs to represent our philosophy. It's like, wow, that's a level of impressive level of detail. Good for you.
And the graphic design in both these games are great, and lots of player aids. Because these
games, but you kind of need them, yeah.
I was going to say, these games, like right out of the gate, they brought the complexity up.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, when I think of the iconography for Mind Clash games, for me, it's universally of the type that is acceptable but not ideal, which is to say, you're probably not going to be able to intuit what the icon means, but once you've been told what it means, you're fine. And that's okay. And given that they've been so aggressive in terms of, more and more as time goes on, actually, of supplying you with more and more player aids of a quality nature, it's hard to begrudge them that too much. Like, but there is going to be a lot. Now, sometimes it kind of collapses under its own weight, though, in that, and this is another thing that Mind Clash does a lot of, with some recent exceptions, but they tend to have... with their crowdfunded projects, I'm thinking especially of Anachrony and Trukerion, a whole bunch of optional mini expansions and modules. And then, of course, when you add on the fact that they then tend to have big box expansions that both Trukerion and Anachrony had, then you have a whole bunch of different reference works to cross, and that's awkward. Then you have to pretty much go to BoardGameGeek and print something up and hope that there's some good omnibus reference.
Yeah, when you have to first look at an index to see which book you need to look at to find the thing you're looking for.
Not ideal.
No.
Which is one of the reasons, I'm jumping around chronologically here, it's one of the reasons why I was so pleased with Voidfall. Because Voidfall is despite how sprawling it is in terms of the amount of stuff, it doesn't have add-on modules. You're either playing competitively or you're playing cooperatively. There's no other, you choose a scenario, sure, but it's not like, well, are you playing with the Pioneers of New Dawn module? Are you playing with this module or the Doomsday module, like with Anachrony? Again, a game I like, but you start to sprawl a little bit. Voidfall, despite how sprawling it could have been, manages to remain relatively focused in comparison, because the moment you've picked your game mode, that's it. You're pretty much done in terms of having to worry about these things. And additionally, it feels strange to talk about Voidfall being focused at all, given how big it is, but it manages that task. And of course, I've talked a lot about how much I adore Voidfall's reference book. It is comprehensive, with one minor exception, and it has everything you need, and it's perfectly comprehensible.
Agreed. Let's get back to where we're supposed to be. After Anachrony came...
Oh, no, come on! That was unnecessary. That was gratuitous.
I know.
Okay, come on.
Content.
All right. What, mockery of me specifically? What?
So, after Anachrony came what we call Cerebra.
The
inside world. And this was just far left court, right?
Oh, yeah.
It was
Gonzo weirdness. Yeah.
Like, not only the game itself, but it's like a team-based...
Yeah.
Theme.
Team-based, kind of, sort of, area majority, but not really.
And you're doing all the emotions of the human mind.
With wild illustrations.
And freaky miniatures.
Yeah, like everything. That's one of the reasons why I love Cerebria so much.
And they have these weird towers that you're building.
Oh,
That are what?
It is a phallic representation of an individual's growing sense of identity. Cerebria is Gonzo in all the best possible ways. That theme hasn't been done that well before. It's a blend of mechanisms that you don't tend to see. It's like deck construction, hand management, area majority, team-based, special power manipulation. Woof. And it's one of those games, and this is a very particular vibe, and I'm using, no pun intended, actually, there are vibes in Cerebria, my apologies. That was awkward. It's a very particular vibe, and that vibe is the game that takes an hour to explain, and then you play in 90 minutes. Yeah, it's very particular.
Compared to the games that came before it, this one plays much, much quicker.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where, kind of like Tribune, kind of like Senji, you have to say to everybody, okay, look, there's a lot going on, and I realize you might have certain expectations about how long a game like this might last. Do not give in to those expectations. It's going to be quicker than you thought it would. Cerebria is, it's weird. On paper, I should hate it. Because normally that balance I don't like. You know, a 45 to 60 minute rules explanation followed by 90 minutes of gameplay. Normally I don't like that. There's very specific terminology you have to do. If you get sloppy with terminology, you could call like four different things upgrade. And that will drive your rules explainer mad. Because the question that I would always get as a rules explainer is, how do upgrades work? And it turns out they weren't talking about upgrades. They were talking about something else. They were talking about the intensify action. Or they were talking about something else. Anyway. But Cerebria was my favorite Mind Clash design. I love Cerebria. It's so restrictive. You want to play it with four. That's the player count.
Yeah.
Maybe two. Maybe. But then you're kind of double-handing. Eh. But I love Cerebria. It's like nothing else, and it's really well done. I don't get to play it enough, partially because it's so restrictive. A heavy Euro, four players only, massive rules explanation.
Great theme.
Great theme, lovely components, but Gonzo art direction in the best possible way.
Yes. You got illustrations that represent feelings, and yeah, so good.
Yeah, yeah. If any of those things sound appealing to you, then you should absolutely go for it. So at that point, and in 2018, I think, is to my mind, was kind of peak Mind Clash. Because at that point, they published Tricarion and Anachrony in Cerebria. Not a dud in the lot. Well, there's the Cerebria card game, but it was kind of a lark off to the side anyway.
And then Anachrony Chess, which was also...
Yeah, they did some side stuff, sure. And another thing that's worth stressing, we're not really in a position to comment yet because the retail version of Voidfall hasn't hit yet. So it's a little bit in flux. But another striking thing about Mind Clash games that was absolutely true for the first three designs, and I hope follows through, their games are shockingly less expensive than much of their competitors. When they hit retail, when you get the retail versions, which are 100% playable, I've joked that there are two ways to play Anachrony with the giant mechs and wrong. But, I mean, to be frank, I'd much be happier. I remember the retail version when it was coming out for like $45 Canadian for the base game of Anachrony. That is a lot of game and a lot of components for not much cash. We're now in a position where retail euros typically go for an excess of 100. And to a large part, Mind Clash, CGE also, their prices seem stuck in the 2010s rather than in the 2020s. Anyway, it's another aspect of Mind Clash's publishing that I've appreciated. Their Kickstarters are expensive and loaded to the gill with plastic. No two ways about it. But their retail offerings, the quote-unquote stripped-down ones, tend to be vastly more reasonable. And I applaud that.
So then there's a bit of a gap.
Yeah. Well, they published the Fractures of Time expansion in 2020 to Anachrony. And for what it's worth, that is our preferred way to play because it really doubles down on the time travel theme. But then again, as we said, you pay the costs of more references to collate and a dense game gets yet denser.
Yeah, more decisions before, you know, you open the box. How are we going to play it this way? Yep. You look at all of these different little add-ons and boxes and stuff, and then you're just like,
It's worth it. I'm willing to power through. The temptation is there. I agree. Yeah. They also published the big box expansion to Tricarion. We did not pursue that because, again, Tricarion's not our preferred of the Mind Clash jams. And then they started to experiment with non-crowdfunded publications.
Yeah, they came out with Astra. It was a very short little sort of astronomical game. And then came Perseverance.
Yeah.
Castaway Chronicles. Episode 1 and 2.
Thank you for the full title. You gotta wait for it.
Now, like on paper, this sounds interesting, right?
Yeah.
You get to this island, and the first one you're like sort of, you know, fighting through these dinosaurs, and you gotta try to make base camp and just survive and not be eaten. And then volume 2, you're like incorporating these beasts in part of your village and getting tech, and you're slowly learning to live on this new island.
Yeah, again, I actually put Perseverance and Septima kind of as a piece, in that there's the thematic promise of some potential collusion with other players while at the same time competing with them, coupled with a political backdrop. Because Perseverance also relies on this political backdrop. In Septima, it's the witch trials. In Perseverance, it's struggle for control over the nascent colony. And we both did not enjoy Perseverance. You know, bland, burdensome.
High manipulation of components with little payoff.
Yep, absolutely. And for me, speaking personally, it was a crushing disappointment because in my head, prior to this, there were pretty much two publishers that did heavy euros with an almost 100% successful track record, Mind Clash and Splatter. And up till that point, as far as I was concerned, they'd done no wrong. And then they did Perseverance. And it was just sometimes when it's not even the weight of expectation, but it's just the weight of past successes. It's like every time I see a new design by some of my favorite designers, I'm like, oh, is this going to be the one that's a stinker? Please don't let this be the one that's a stinker.
Yeah, and the promises made, like, there's going to be this campaign system, and you can link all these games together.
Seamlessly and easily, yeah, right? It's not really a campaign, but you're going to be able to transition from one to the other. And
tell this whole story, and it'll be great.
It wasn't.
It was not.
And all of our fears, because we both had this concern. I remember talking about it on Pledge of Indifference. We were both concerned that it was going to fall prey to some of the rules problems in series games. This happens in war games all the time, even whether they're heavy or light, you know, when Undaunted. Wait, is this the one where it works like every other game in the series, or is this the one that's different? With Perseverance Castaway Chronicles, it was exactly that. It's like, okay, I remember that one of them works like A and one of them works like B. I don't remember which one's which. is this the rule that got changed or is this the rule that's the same between the both? So suddenly, the fact that 90 to 95% of the rules could be the same makes it a problem rather than a virtue.
Yeah, and they came out, you know, together. So yeah. That even worse.
Yeah, yeah. And again, not that... I don't think either, speaking for myself, I didn't hate Perseverance. No. It's mostly, again, the weight of expectation, the weight of past successes, the disappointment as a manifestation of the theme. That's why I speak with such disappointment and borderline bitterness, not because it was truly execrable, but mostly just because it was workmanlike and mediocre. What's the gender-neutral term for workmanlike? Worker-like? That might be misleading. Anyway, I should just retire that word from my vocabulary then. It was just pedestrian and uninspired, which is truly sad. And I was ready to think that this was just like, okay, maybe mine class... I'm trying to put a narrative and a pattern where there shouldn't be one. Right. So in my head, I was like, okay, Mindclash was a top tier publisher, and now they're just like every other publisher. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. And Voidfall was announced. I'm like, whatever. David Tsertse, I liked Anachrony, and Anachrony's great, but he's also done a lot of other stuff I don't like. Voidfall, huh? Yeah, okay. And I was not ready to like Voidfall half as much as I did.
And you can see there is some similarities as well with Voidfall and Septima. You can see how some, I think maybe they're developed together. Type thing, because in both games you have this set of cards, and it's this huge decision on, and you know how many turns are in the round,
mm-hmm.
and you get to decide beforehand. It's like, okay, these are the five cards for five turns I want to play.
I see what you're saying,
and so you're planning it out, and so you know what you're doing. There is a little similarity there.
I guess I don't know if they were developed at the same time. I mean, presumably there's some cross pollination from the various designers that work at Mindclash. But we reviewed Voidfall a couple months ago when it came out. Voidfall crawled under my skin in a way that I did not anticipate. I love Voidfall. It's marvelous. It is going to feature prominently, I think, in our end-of-year recap episode. And especially on the heels of Perseverance. And given the fact that Nigel Buckle doesn't have much of a publication history. Granted, he worked in Imperium, which is one of my favorite deck builders of the past few years, but I just wasn't ready for how good Voidfall was. And once again, you get... I haven't seen the retail version too closely yet, but Voidfall, you can get all the metal components if you want, with plastic spaceships and double-layered everything and this, that, and the other. Or if you don't want or need any of that, you can just get tokens, and that's fine. And I really appreciate that kind of scope.
Yep. We already talked. I don't want to go too much into Voidfall. We've talked about it already in the show. Lots of fantastic things. Determinative combat, which makes the game play very quickly.
Yep.
Very interesting resource system of where you're improving the planets with guilds and population, which set your resources. Different technologies that you can get. Goal cards that you have to incorporate into your strategy. You have to get the card, and then it has to be played with a certain other card in order for you to play it. Lots of things going on.
And let me just focus on one more thing, and I've said this before about Voidfall, but I think it serves as a nice contrast to Septima. There's hardly any round maintenance compared to actual play. In Voidfall, there's hardly any upkeep. There's some, sure, but in comparison to you actually doing your actions, There's no resource production phase. If you produce resources, you produce them because you chose to. That's an action you took. Same thing with combat. Same thing with chasing after people.
It's fine. They give me the same sort of feeling at the end of the round where you have this sort of already predetermined, the hunter's going to attack. You're going to get attacked.
Oh, that's fair. You're right.
Right? And it's like, it usually ends up being nothing or being devastating, right? One or the other.
That's
right?
Fair.
Either you've made a mistake, Or it means nothing at all.
That's fair. You and I have talked about the counterattack in Voidfall, the skirmish, as it were, from the Voidborn. And, you know, we disagree as to its relative value, but you're right. That is one commonality between Voidfall and Septima. And then there's their upcoming Ironwood, which is, again, going to be a direct-to-retail experience. It's not going to be crowdfunded. It's going to be a two-player card-battling type thing. I'm cautiously optimistic. I like those kinds of games. We'll see what happens. But I mean, yeah, if you just look at the games that they produce that we like, you know, specifically Anachrony, Cerebria, and Voidfall, even if you leave out Tricarion, which we enjoyed, but it wasn't one of our favorites, that's an impressive pedigree over the course of a publisher that's basically been in the business for 8 years.
Agreed.
Since the publication in 2015 of Tricarion. That alone is impressive. I mean, yeah, we haven't been huge fans of the rest, and there's absolutely similar consistent to quality in terms of heavy Euro designs, which, unfortunately, in the rest of the market, I seldom see, personally.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to all their upcoming stuff. I like how they're cycling through different designers.
Even Perseverance Castaway Chronicles episodes 3 and 4? You're looking forward to that, Walker?
I am.
Really?
Maybe they've heard. Like, it doesn't sound as though it was well received by everyone.
Yeah, my perception is that the enthusiasm was much more muted compared to their other stuff.
And maybe they noticed that. So maybe they're going to make some changes. Maybe they're going to readdress some things. Maybe it's going to be different.
One can hope. Well, suffice to say, we will be looking at the future output of Mind Clash with enthusiasm. That's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for this episode of So Very Wrong About Games. We genuinely appreciate any time you decide to spend with us. If you'd like to reach out and get in touch, you can find our contact information at sowronggames.com/contact. We read everything you send and we'll get back to you if we can. We hope to see you again soon, and we also hope that you take care.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.